First, I guess, was it Javier that brought up the point about the FCC versus BCT, that the FCC is a special case of BCT, and therefore why have it as a separate category? And I think the answer is that it's a higher symmetry. FCC belongs to the cubic group, and it's a higher symmetry than BCT. So just like you have a simple cube, and you also have tetragonal, which is just an elongated cube. Obviously, a cube is a special case of tetragonal, but you still call them two different Bravais lattices because the cube has higher symmetry. Yeah.
Isn't the only reason you give one of these lattices an explicit name just because there's some fancy example that comes up often that is like of that form?
No. This is. We also had this discussion this morning. These are enumeration of what's possible. Then what happens in nature is a different story. What happens in nature...
What you were talking about yesterday also occurred, but it didn't have a separate name. Like, it's also possible.
Which?
No?
The
general thing didn't have another name, but the more specific version did have a name.
I'm not sure what you're... When we were doing the graphene lattice, the honeycomb? So just to be clear, though, these are enumeration of what's possible. So there's, for example, in two dimensions in particular, there's nothing there with five-fold symmetry because you can't actually tile a plane with a unit cell that has five-fold symmetry. So you get this Penrose tiling, which is referred to as quasi-crystalline, but it's not perfectly crystalline. Okay, so we've just looked at the chronic penny model, and there's a leap from going from the chronic penny model to what are referred to as band structure calculations. And I'm going to try and make that leap a little smoother. So I'm going to tell you a bit about some sort of elementary calculations that allow you to do band structure calculations, if you like. So band structure calculations are a huge field. But as I said, we're going to do the simplest sort of case. And it does require numerical work, but I want to make that as less mysterious as possible. So let me start. So first, you've all learned, and the other thing that has always bothered me when I've been learning condensed matter in particular is it has a lot of jargon associated with it, and there's a lot of condensed matter baggage, as I refer to it, and I'd like to make it as much like quantum mechanics as possible. The root of it all is quantum mechanics. So this first part of this lecture is sort of an attempt to do that. So let me start with something you've all learned, which is that when you're solving the Schrodinger equation, what you've all done in your undergraduate studies is you've examined the potential Coulomb harmonic oscillator, and then you've solved the differential equation. But I'm almost 100% certain that somewhere along the road, you also learned that you can expand psi in a complete basis set, and if that basis set, so let me use Braquette notation. If they're enumerated by the wave functions phi, then they have these arbitrary coefficients that you have to figure out. Okay, I'm sure you've written this down. And then you've substituted in here, and so you get that h on phi j sum over j with coefficients a, j is equal to e times sum over j a sub j phi j. And then if I take the inner product with every single one of those basis states, the phi i's, I end up with the following equation. And I've assumed that this basis set is orthonormal. So that's what's allowed me to do that. And then this, you realize, is simply a matrix equation. Right? If I write it out like H is a matrix, these matrix elements H, I, J are simply these things. So have all of you seen this? Have any of you ever solved one of these? I mean, we all do it, but then we move on, as far as I can tell. Has anyone ever solved? So this is what you do in what I call chapter 3 or chapter 4 of every quantum mechanics book. You do all this stuff. You study about Hermitian matrices and adjoints and so on, and then you move on. So I don't know that anybody's here has ever solved one of these. So when I teach undergraduate quantum mechanics, the students in my class actually solve these. They take out MATLAB or Mathematica, and they just solve a 30 by 30 or 100 by 100 matrix numerically. Okay, you call up some eigenfunction routine. So the example I use is something that's familiar to them and to you, presumably, which is the harmonic oscillator. You've all solved the harmonic oscillator. Presumably, you've done it two ways. You've done it by actually solving the differential equation and the Frobenius method, and you've also done it with these magical Dirac raising and lowering operators. Okay, well, this is a third way, and the way it's done is you want to solve for this potential, for example. So this is just one. The only reason we're using this example is because it's familiar to you. How do we solve that? Well, we have to put it in what I call a universe. So we put it in an infinite square well. Okay, and I'm going to make that infinite square well go from 0 to a. Normally we use our infinite square wells to go from minus a over 2 to a over 2, so it's got that nice symmetry. But the reason why I choose 0 to a is because I can write down the eigenstates all in one shot. Right? These eigenstates are root 2 over a sine n pi x over a, and we might as well label them n.
How big do we choose these blocks to be? Because we will cut.
Excellent. Yes. So, Tomasz?
No.
He's Tomasz. Juan.
Yeah.
Yes. So Juan rightly points out that this is, I'm not solving the harmonic oscillator anymore. I'm solving this thing truncated at the sides. So the answer to your question is, if I'm not happy, I make it twice as big. And if I'm not happy with that, I make it twice as big again. And I do it to the point that I'm happy. Now, that's not as bad as it sounds, because this is what we do in all of physics. We're going to learn about phonons, later on, and we're going to use the harmonic oscillator approximation there. In reality, all our potentials in nature, I don't know, they have some form that looks like this. And then what we do is we sort of said, oh, look at this. This looks like it's a, well, if we've got an equilibrium situation, it has to have a minimum like that. And it essentially has to be quadratic. And so then we say, okay, we're going to approximate this by that potential, and then you're going to say, oh, wait a minute, that's not right. The potential is different here. But depending on the problem we are addressing, this could be, if this is say a 10 electron volt scale, right? 10 electron volts. Do you remember what that is? That's 11,605 degrees Kelvin in temperature units. So if you're conducting experiments that are at 10 degrees Kelvin, right, then thermodynamically, you're never going to access regions where this potential varies. So you don't care. You only care that it's a faithful representation down here, you know, where it might be hundreds of degrees Kelvin high, because you're only doing experiments down at 5 degrees Kelvin. And even in cosmology, you make similar types of arguments. So it's a sort of a more universal idea. And again, you'll see the answer to your question as we proceed. So like I said, we choose this between 0 and 8 because I've got this. If I made it symmetric, do you remember what the answers are? Half of them are sine functions, half of them are cosine functions, right? Because they're even and odd. But these, even though this looks like it's an odd function, is actually these alternate even and odd around the middle here. So they're a handy set. And we also know the eigen energies. They're pi squared, h bar squared, n squared, over 2m a squared. So that's the basis, in fact, that we use to solve this problem. Okay, then what's in here? What's in here is there's and this is, we're doing one dimension for now. This is a derivative squared. Second derivative, and so it returns the sine function after two derivatives, and you pull out the n pi over a, right? So you get basically these guys. And what else is in here is this potential. This potential is 1/2 m omega squared x minus a over 2 all squared, right? And I can do all those integrals analytically. So I can actually, I have it, rather than write it out, if I can get the screen down, please. So what I'm going to show you are these matrix elements. So here they are. Okay, there's a bunch that are diagonal. Okay, there's your n squared. Okay, that's coming from the eigen states, which are covered underneath here. I normalize them to E10. So E10 here is simply pi squared h bar squared over 2m a squared. So it's the lowest level for the square well. And that's why you've only got n squared. And these are just numbers. The only parameter that comes in here is this h bar omega over E10. This is covered up as well, so let me draw it again here. So that looks like you're choosing whether you want that kind of parabola or this kind of parabola. But by making a choice for this parameter, you're doing exactly what Juan pointed out. You're adjusting the width of that well. Okay, so if you're interested in low-lying states like this, this is not a good choice. This is a better choice, and you can make it even further. So just by way of an example, I don't know if you can see the faint green parabola up there, but that's the example we're using. And there's this is nice. There's a faint green line here, which is the analytical result that you know and love. It's h bar omega times n, and I have to subtract a half because of the way I've enumerated these n's. N here is a positive integer, and normally for the harmonic oscillator, n starts at 0. But for the infinite square well, it starts at 1. That's why we subtract a half. So there's the analytical result. And if you diagonalize a say 70 by 70 matrix, the eigenvalues you get are the red squares. Okay, so if you were to simply do an infinite square well, you can do the answer analytically, you get the blue curve. But if you actually solve for this harmonic oscillator, you get the red squares. And you could see it peels off from the harmonic oscillator result for the very reason that you again pointed out immediately, that this is not a harmonic oscillator, it's a harmonic oscillator truncated at some point. But I can make this peel off way up here if I want by making the infinite square well wider, making my universe in which I solve this problem wider. And these are the wave functions. Actually, it's the absolute value. Oh, these got shifted. There's a typo. I didn't put absolute value here, but these are the absolute values of the wave function. And this is really to illustrate that at n equals 20, you've basically got the exact results for the ground state. This is the ground state result. Of course, if you go up to the excited states up here, they will be wrong as far as the harmonic oscillator go, but you know that.
Those on the side are interference patterns because the wave function reflected upon the sides. There's a possibility of wave function coming back from the side.
Yes, okay. More or less. Another way of saying it is that this is, you're just doing a Fourier decomposition here. And whenever you expand things in Fourier components, there's something called Gibbs oscillations that will always show up. And these are Gibbs oscillations. But to me, the astounding thing is that by 20, it's a really good reproduction. And why it works is, again, if you know the answer in advance, it helps. Why it works is because the wave function is going to zero anyways. Wave function doesn't have the slightest idea that there are infinite square well walls. That's only been used as a basis. Okay, the purpose of that was so I would have a basis. And these are just numbers that go into this matrix. So at the time, this was just a sort of a way of solving problems that you know, I used to tell, or I still tell my undergraduate students that I work in condensed matter, I work in superconductivity, I've used quantum mechanics all my life, I do nothing except solve the Schrodinger equation, and I've never ever solved a differential equation in my life. Of course, that's all you're exposed to as an undergraduate. You think solving the Schrodinger equation is about solving a differential equation. We don't do it. We solve matrix equations. That's the way we do the Hubbard model, which I'll tell you about later on, any mini-body problem. And I don't know how it is in other fields, but in our field, this is what we do. And so it frustrated me when every textbook had a chapter 3 that talked about this stuff, but only talked about it formally. This is just a way of doing it in a simple, concrete way. But then things moved on, and why I'm introducing this here is because this had applicability to what we've just been talking about, periodic potentials. Okay, so there's a paper in that same journal. So this American Journal of Physics that I told you about yesterday briefly is like a teaching journal. It's a great journal to read papers that you can actually understand because they make great efforts to make the work that's presented there accessible to undergraduates and graduate students, and it's got a pedagogical nature like the problems I'm talking about here. So it occurred to me that, you know, in this problem, we set up this infinite square well, and suppose I want to do a periodic lattice. Then, well, the first thing that occurred to me is, okay, make your infinite square well, and then put in a potential here that looks like this. Okay, and then you've got a periodic lattice, you know, of size 8. And if you're not happy with that, then do it again and, make it, in reality, make the well twice as wide and then make it 16. And by the way, I'm drawing chronic penny type periodic potential, but as soon as I've got this machinery in place, right, I need to compute these matrix elements. So there's nothing stopping me now from solving a periodic potential like this that actually looks like that, right? It doesn't have to have analytical form because this is just going into a matrix element and I have to do some integral. That's it. And most of the integrals I still do analytically, I can do them numerically if I need to. But, so that's one approach. But then, you know, we had been doing this stuff on Bloch's theorem and so on. I said, well, why do we need these are the open boundary conditions. Why do we need to use that? Why can't we use periodic boundary conditions? So if we use periodic boundary conditions, then let's go back to the harmonic oscillator. I don't know how to draw this. It's as if I've drawn this in a circle now, right? Because this thing here just wraps around and comes here. So it's just a different choice of boundary conditions. And if the boundary conditions truly don't matter in the end, then it doesn't matter if they're big walls or if they're just periodic. So that's what we did first in this paper, is we solved the same problem. And I don't think I show it here. We solved the same problem, but with periodic boundary conditions. And the answers were the same. Meaning, of course, you're going to get the right answer, but the convergence was just as good. Okay, because convergence is always an issue. I should have said something earlier. Most of you will have noticed that I refrained. You know, I wrote J equals 1, and I didn't put the upper limit, because the upper limit is infinity. But of course, we have to choose a cutoff, because you can't diagonalize an infinite matrix on a computer. And so all of these have a cutoff. And that's where the convergence comes in. As it turns out, the cutoff, it works very, very well. As I said, you could get away with a 20 by 20 matrix and solve for these wave functions up to about 8 digits of accuracy. So once I've established this works, what's the next step?
Once you establish
that periodic boundary conditions works just as well as as the open boundary conditions.
Choose some basis, maybe.
No, sorry, with periodic boundary conditions, I have to choose a basis as well, and that basis is now plane waves. No, I've done that, right? You can't use sine functions anymore because they have to have the right behavior to be periodic. I'd use the block condition, right? If I use the block condition, then I don't have to draw all these multiple wells. So the magic of the block condition is, let me draw a chronic penny well like that, okay? If I use periodic boundary conditions, I am studying the properties of a single well. Okay, if I use the block condition, which is that one, then I'm no longer studying the properties. I'm only solving the problem here, but I'm now solving an infinite array of these potentials just by using that block condition. Okay, and that's why I wanted to warm up with the periodic boundary condition, because I wanted to make sure that I could then do this. And as it turns out, when you calculate these matrix elements, so you have to do the same thing now, these matrix elements here, and they're actually easier because they're these exponentials, then the only place where the block condition changes things compared to the periodic boundary condition is in this additional k here. Okay, we use capital K here. Capital K is like the lowercase k that I've been using. Okay, so I now have it set up that I need to simply solve a problem, and of course I'm not necessarily going to use this. I could use something like this. And I don't have to stick to one dimension anymore. I can go to two and three dimensions.
So, and you include your block condition with your basis, or you include as new equations in your linear system?
The basis is n pi x over a. And then the block condition imposes a condition on those values of n. Yes?
So you said that you're not actually solving a differential equation, you're just solving matrix equation.
Yes.
Which means you're probably going to diagonalize Hamiltonian.
Yes.
For a three-dimensional lattice.
Yes.
How many sites are you going to have? Three?
No, you're...
Like, you cannot possibly diagonalize anything of dimension, like, I don't know, 1,000 or something. You just can't go higher than that.
Okay, the computer does let's say 1,000 by 1,000 easily. Okay, but now when we're working in three dimensions, I want a solid, right? So I want 10^23 in that direction, 10^23 in this direction, 10^23 in that direction. But I'm telling you, I'm getting not 10^23 actually, but infinite numbers in all those directions by simply solving in one unit cell. I'm not doing, you know, what I drew earlier, which is this. I'm not doing that, right? I'm not doing that. I'm just doing one well, but then by putting block boundary conditions, the one that's written there with the e to the ika, I'm actually, by solving in this unit cell for this one well, I'm actually solving for an infinite array.
Okay, so you have two differences. How do you link them together?
Which two?
You have a unit cell on one hand side and an infinite lattice in three dimensions on the other. How do you link them together? You can't just be like, now I have many of them, so I'm going to put one particle in every one.
No, Bloch's theorem links them together. So remember what we did yesterday. Yesterday I drew what would be an infinite array of potential wells, right? I had something like this. And then I matched boundary conditions here, and then I matched boundary conditions here, and then I said, oh, now we're gonna need to know the next stuff. But I said, this will go on forever if I do this. And so yesterday I said, no, let's just use Bloch's theorem to relate what's happening over here back to here. And that's what we did, and the system of equations closed, and there were just four unknowns, four unknown amplitudes. And we got our result, which was then valid for an infinite array, even though we focused on one unit cell in that problem. That's what we are doing now in general.
So just for any, I can't just take any system which has some discrete translation invariance, just solve for one unit part, and I suddenly have it for an infinite array. There's huge problems in physics that you're telling me we can just solve like that.
Okay, so the answer to the first part, which you said you can't do that, is the answer is you can. So that's what Bloch's theorem is about. The answer to the second part, which is saying that there are these huge problems in physics, and you know you can't just solve them. You're correct. You're talking now about interacting particles. I'm talking about a single particle. We put a single particle in this periodic array, and we ask, what are the states available to that single particle? And that we can do for an infinite array.
3D Henderson localization with one particle.
Yes?
You can solve that like that.
No, 3D Anderson localization involves non-periodicity. You've broken the periodicity by introducing impurities. This has to be a periodic array. Actually, I have things to say about Anderson localization based on this methodology, but you can't solve that problem because it's not a periodic potential. I can't resist showing you, though. Let me see. How does this work? How come I can't resist showing you this. This is all work actually done with undergraduates. I have a lot of fun working with these people. So this is another American Journal of Physics. I'm going to give you a quiz. This is a double well. Okay, it's a double well, there's a barrier in between. What's the right answer for the ground state? That's the wave function drawing there.
What is the question?
What is the correct answer, the top figure or the bottom figure for the ground state for this double well?
Could you ask a question that you have to give an answer for? You're asking what's the answer.
I said, which is the right answer? The top figure?
What question?
What is the correct wave function? Those are pictures of the wave function. Pardon? It's the square of the wave. It's the amplitude, yeah. Sorry. Square, yeah. Yeah, I mean, you've done the double well, right? You should all say it's the top figure, right? Because it's a linear superposition of being on the left side and the right side. Well, actually, the right answer is the bottom figure. Because what I've done, and I've it's completely legitimate because the figures are accurate, but the well on the right-hand side in these units, well, in these units, so these units, the barrier height is 500. Okay, so in those units, whatever those units are, the well on the right-hand side is 10 to the minus 7 lower than the well on the left-hand side. And when it's 10 to the minus 7 lower than the right left-hand side, this is the correct answer. Not that one. Okay? And so, is it Nick?
Yes.
Nick. So that's essentially an example of Anderson localization for two cells, right? It's not a periodic lattice yet, but that's something we are also interested in, extending this to larger lattices. Okay, we can't use this method, but that's another question. Okay, so, but again, this is done through these diagonalization techniques. And the point is that, well, there's a work done here, for example, on quantum information and qubits and things like that. And this double well potential could serve as an example for a qubit. But if you have errors in how you make these double wells of, you know, 10 to the minus 7 parts in 500, it's not going to work. That's the message here. Anyways, that's just showing off. I'm proud of this, that particular result. So to summarize my answer to Nick, if you're dealing with a single particle and you've got the power of Bloch's theorem and you use those periodic boundary conditions, you can indeed focus on one cell. And you focus on one cell, you solve the problem in that one cell, and then you've solved it for the entire array. Okay, and that's behind all band structure calculations. Okay, and it's the power of Bloch's theorem. And what this has done, hopefully, is you know, this has been known since the 30s, but this is to make it more accessible to students who are learning about it. So the matrix, in fact, that you have to diagonalize is exactly the same as you would for a single cell, except now in the diagonals, there's this Ka over pi, and K can vary. K will vary between, it'll be any wave vector within the first Brillouin zone. Okay, so I'm hoping that has sunk in. Unfortunately, the only way I think one can learn this is if you're forced to actually solve these problems yourself. But these are a little, they're a bit time consuming. So I've talked about the harmonic oscillator potential, but why don't I just test this out with the chronic penny potential? So that means I'm just going to go back here and I'm going to solve that problem. Okay? And if I use Bloch's boundary condition, then what I'm solving for is this infinite array going on forever. Okay? And so these are the results. This is a function of k in units of a over pi. Okay, I've superimposed the potential. Okay, it's in the wrong space. The potential is a function of position, not a function of wave vector. But the height of the potential is correct. This is an energy diagram, and these are the energies of the barriers, okay? And down here, you can call it zero. So who was it yesterday that said that the bands would be very flat? Yeah, Juan? So you see that the blue guy here is indeed very flat looking, and now the red guy starts to have some dispersion. And once you get above, of course, they have dispersion, and if you go up higher and higher, they'll start to look like the free electron dispersions. And the circles here are just solutions from this equation, and the lines are the numerical solutions. Okay. Again, if I had done this problem with these eight cells. Remember what I said yesterday, there are as many points in reciprocal space as there are in real space. Since I've got eight cells in real space, I can only draw eight dots instead of those continuous lines. But when I use Bloch's theorem to solve the problem, I've got an infinite number. I can choose k to be anything I like. So I can draw continuous curves like these blue ones. And the circles come from this solving this equation, they could be continuous curves as well, but just for clarity, I use symbols for them. By the way, again, one of the most amazing things about this, to me at least, is remember I told you about the gaps that show up? And of course, indeed, there's a big gap between these two levels. And then there's a gap between these two levels, and then there's a gap between those two levels, and then there's another gap, and that keeps on going. So these are now levels well above the maximum potential here. Okay, so what does that gap mean? It means that energy is not allowed. So in principle, if you are in an airplane flying overhead of a corrugated surface like this, there's certain energies you're not allowed to be in. You can't fly at certain speeds because there's a gap, which I find amazing. Now, we went and proceeded in this paper and solved for a bunch of potentials. You can even solve for something that looks like a Coulomb potential. Although, yeah, we did, but we didn't publish this one. And you get a variety. What we wanted to see is what is the dependence of these bands on the actual potential shape? Because in the end, these are not squares. These are actually harmonic oscillators. They're not harmonic oscillators either. They're effective Coulomb potentials. So we looked at a variety of of examples, and I mean, you can't tell what's different so much about this compared to the others, but the one thing that is of interest in condensed matter is, especially in semiconductors, is what is the effective mass? So we actually focused on the green. So in all five or six of those cases with different potentials, there is this green band that's up near the top level of the potential. So it's still below the top level, but close to it. That green band has a certain curvature here. That means that if you put one electron in there, and it would reside in the, so these are all filled, say. So say they're core electrons. So in sodium, these would correspond to all the states below 3s. Then the 3s has one state in it. Suppose it's this one. What band mass would that experience? On the other hand, if you could dope sodium so that you filled up this band except for one electron, so you had one hole, what band mass would it have? So we tabulated those, and that's the right. So the right column is the ratio of the second derivatives of the normalized energy. So it's just the ratio of the effective masses. So this is the whole effective mass divided by the electron effective mass. Okay, there's minus signs because, of course, holes have negative mass. The curvature is negative. But notice they're not one. They're half or even lower. Okay, and what is it? It's the whole mass is lower than the electron mass. Can anyone tell me why? Or what you would expect? We're going to talk about tight binding next lecture. And in tight binding, at least in the simplest cases, these effective masses are equal. The whole mass is the same as the electron mass. In fact, you'll have a tutorial tomorrow where you'll use an example where that's true. This, to me, is now obvious in hindsight, and this is a pedagogical exercise, but I've never seen this stated in the literature. Why is the whole mass lighter than the electron mass? It's because holes, by definition, occupy the states at the top of the band. So they're up at these energies. The energy at the top of the band is that much closer to the top of the barrier than these ones. It's not a lot, but it's closer. So the holes, in order to tunnel through this barrier here to the next well, have a smaller barrier than the electrons. And it's that tunneling probability that determines that largely determines their effective mass. That also explains why these numbers are even smaller than these. These are the chronic penny ones. These ones are examples like the one I just showed you. No, not that one. Where as you go up, because of the shape of the potential, the barrier is actually getting narrower. So not only are you gaining because you're up near the top of the band, but you've got a narrower barrier to tunnel through. So you get an even bigger effect. You get basically a third in some cases.
Why don't we get the same effect when we're considering tight binding?
I will show you that. But to answer your question quickly, because in tight binding, the assumption is that that the electrons are tightly bound. The electron that's here is basically going to stay here. That's true for these states. These states have this huge barrier, right? And whether you have to tunnel from this energy, which is actually slightly lower than this energy, or this energy, doesn't make a lot of difference. You will see some asymmetry there too. And that's a good point too. This looks like to all of you like a straight line. And I will show you tomorrow an even more extreme example that if I blow up that scale, it'll look like this. Okay, which looks like the tight binding result. Okay. And here in a sort of an animation, you can, so what's happening here is we're simply changing the barrier height and recalculating the band structure, and you can see two things. One is everything moves upwards, right? That's expected because you're putting in barriers. At the same time, you are moving away from the free electron behavior. So when this thing goes back down, those are parabolas folded back on one another. They're like the figure I drew yesterday on the board or tried to draw. They're just parabolas. And some of them start over here, and some of them, so that red one goes through. And then when you increase the barriers, those parabolas start to split apart. And that's what we're going to talk about in today's lecture. How they split apart and form these gaps. I'll show you this figure as well. I'll show it to you again later, but this is from Ashcroft and Merman, and the figure I drew yesterday was something like this, and it's just showing you what we're going to talk about today is how that splitting arises. Right at that point. If I were to superimpose this figure and that figure, it would not differ that much, except right here. That's the point of the rest of today's lecture. And again, just to get you used to all the jargon that comes in condensed matter, you can draw these energy bands. I've been emphasizing this picture. All that matters is the first Brillouin zone. And these, of course, are all in one dimension. All that matters is the first Brillouin zone. And that's called the reduced zone scheme. You can have something called the extended zone scheme, where now you take this picture and you extend it to the other. You know, that looks more like a parabola that's been broken up, the top one, right? So if you reduce the potential to zero, that top one collapses to a single parabola. And that helps you, it gives you some familiarity with something you know, which is the free electron dispersion, which is just k squared. This, you know, is not so obvious, but it's the same information, and this is just taking this thing and extending it periodically, because the point here is that it doesn't matter whether you're out here outside the first Brillouin zone, it's identical to what's happening in the first Brillouin zone. And that's what this picture emphasizes. Okay, I might as well show you this one too. This is what happens in three dimensions. First of all, you can't draw it very well. These symbols down here represent particular directions in three-dimensional wave vector space. And this is for the free electron. So these are all parabolas. They're parabolas that originate somewhere else, like maybe out here, and then they form an arc that goes through that region, which is the first Brillouin zone. Okay, so you can see why we tend to do examples in one dimension, because things get kind of complicated. In particular, what we're going to talk about now is when there's a degeneracy. So in three, so what I want you to keep in mind is in three dimensions, you know, there could be places where the degeneracy is quite large. There's like five or so bands that have the same energy there. Whereas in one dimension, just looking at this one, the degeneracy is always two at most. I can't get another parabola to go through that point. And that would be true for basically any place where the parabolas intersect. Okay, any questions before we move on to... I've got an expression, I'm not going to write it down because of time, but it's in the notes that'll be posted later. Because one of the things I wondered about is in the free electron limit, what's the curvature here? It's going to be the free electron mass, or the inverse mass. So then you say, okay, so, but we have to add a potential to this. We're gonna add a weak potential today. So then masses in solids masses of electrons should be related to the free electron mass. Yeah. On the other hand, in solids, the mass, the band mass, is more a function of how big these barriers are. That determines how itinerant or how mobile this electron is going to be. That has nothing to do with the free electron mass. And this expression explains, doesn't explain it, but it gives you a hint that you can have both limits and things are a function of these potentials in not so obvious ways. It's actually a project I'm working on right now. So when I teach these courses, some project always emerges and I grab students from the class and they end up working on them. So it's kind of a thing that goes back and forth like that. Okay, so if we could have the screen go back up now, I'm gonna go back to the board. Thank you. So what I want to do, and I think I will try and move quickly. Well, I don't want to move quickly, but I'll get wherever I get, and the notes will be there. So the mid... So I want to specifically discuss the case of weak potentials. And you could ask yourself why, because, you know, loosely speaking, the kinetic energy of an electron is given by a scale that is that combination of things. So it's h bar squared over 2 ME times the Laplacian, but has an energy scale of 1 over the Bohr radius. And that you might recognize is 13.6 electron volts. But on the other hand, the interaction energy between two electrons, or even between an electron and the nucleus, goes like that, which is E squared over A naught. And if I put the 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught then I know how to convert this to Bohr radii, and this turns out to be h bar squared over m e a naught squared, which is twice that, which is 27.2 electron volts. By the way, this is referred to by the chemistry community as a Rydberg, and also by the chemistry community, they make up a name for this guy, and they call it a Hartree. So you might see those terms here and there. So this doesn't look weak at all. But if you think about solids, so you've got this array, and this represents an attractive potential for an electron. Where is the electron going to spend most of its time? It's going to spend its time here, where that interaction is strong. That's not true. What that leaves out is what's referred to as a pseudo-potential effect. Pseudo-potential. Which is that electrons have to obey the Pauli exclusion principle. And in something like sodium, there are electrons that are so-called core electrons that are here all the time at each one of these cores. So the electron that it is able to float around, which in the case of sodium is the 3s electron, is not going to, it's going to have nodes. It's going to have, be close to zero in amplitude in the vicinity of these other electrons for reasons of the Pauli exclusion principle. And not entirely, but that's, and that's just by virtue of the Pauli exclusion principle. That's not even thinking of interactions at the moment. And so the amplitude is less than you would think here. It'll spend most of its time here, and then the potential does look weak because it's not much of a potential. That's one reason, and the second reason is screening. If you're in a situation where you're talking about a metal, then the electrons are nimble, at least the ones that can move around, and they will diffuse a situation where there's a large potential. They'll screen out any positive charge as readily as they can. So the fact, when you're focusing on what one electron sees, the fact that there are other electrons that will contribute to screening also weakens the overall effect of these wells. But anyways, we can examine this as an exercise for weak potential. So we start with the periodicity. And again, I'm not going to derive this, but it's in one of the appendices. But you would normally write this as kind of a Fourier transform of that potential. But in fact, you are able to write this, where these are the reciprocal lattice vectors. Okay, and that's a much better thing to be able to do than to just expand in terms of all wave vectors. You can just expand in terms of the reciprocal lattice vectors. So, but psi you can't do that because psi doesn't have this periodicity property. Okay? But you'll see that there's a simplification that occurs. So when we write h times psi equals e times epsilon times psi, then this has the minus h bar squared over 2m times a Laplacian. So that pulls down an IQ squared. And so you get h bar squared Q squared over 2 m e sum over Q, and then times CQ e to the IQ dot R. So that's the kinetic energy piece. Just Fourier transformed. And then I'm going to have the potential energy, so that's Fourier transform V of R, and then this is for psi, and this is going to equal epsilon times the sum over Q CQ e to the I Q dot R. If I call this epsilon Q zero, then I can write this as sum over Q epsilon Q zero minus epsilon, so I bring that over, times CQ e to the I Q dot R. And then here, since I have these two exponentials, then I should probably make the substitution that Q prime is equal to Q plus G. And so I will write down plus sum over Q prime now, C Q prime minus G, and then e to the I Q prime dot R, and I have in here sum over G VG, and this is equal to zero. So this sum over G. And I should have said at the start here, we're free to choose the zero of this. So I'm going to choose, the inverse of this is 1 over the volume times integral d cubed r e to the minus I g dot r times v of r. So I'm going to choose v of g equals 0 equal to 0. Okay, when g is equal to zero, this isn't there. So I'm choosing basically the center of mass of the potential to be zero. I can float this wherever I want. I have to put zero somewhere, and that's going to decide where I put it. So if I invert this, it's a sum over q of stuff times e to the I q dot r. If I change this dummy variable q prime back to q, then that means, and this is equal to zero, that means the stuff has to be zero. So I end up with epsilon. Before I do that, hold on. I wanted to do one other thing. I wanted to write, this is for any Q. Let me write this out first. So epsilon naught q epsilon minus epsilon q zero is going to be equal to times CQ is going to be equal to the sum over G VG times C q minus g. And this is for any q, and now I'm going to write q is equal to k minus g. So let me call this summation g prime so I don't get confused. That's a dummy variable. I'm going to write k is equal to k minus q, where k is in the first Brillouin zone. So this is valid for any q, but I want k to be in the first Brillouin zone. And I know I can always get there through some reciprocal lattice vector. Yes? By definition, I'm defining it to be zero because I have to put zero somewhere. I have to make this overall potential have a zero somewhere, and this is one way of setting where it's zero. Doesn't follow. No, no, no. It's by definition. Yeah. So if we substitute that, then the equation looks like this. And there should be vectors over all of these, but I'm going to refrain from doing that. I want to change variables here and write g double prime is equal to g prime plus g. And so this is going to equal sum over g double prime v of g double prime minus g times ck minus g double prime. So this is true for any wave vector k and any reciprocal lattice vector g. G double prime is a dummy variable. So when you look at this, you realize that this equation couples these coefficients c to not all the other coefficients. It only couples this coefficient c to all other coefficients that are connected by a reciprocal lattice vector. Okay, that means that, you know, we were forced to write this in general, it's a function of q, but now we can actually write psi with the label k as simply a sum over reciprocal lattice vectors. Okay, so it has a similar property to the potential. Everything is still exact. And now I want to just examine this equation. Suppose all the potentials are zero. Then we're going to find that epsilon is, if all the potentials are zero, this right-hand side is zero. The left-hand side has to be zero. then this will equal epsilon k minus g for a particular g, and that coefficient will be of order unity. And for the other g's, this will be nowhere near that energy, and most of these coefficients will be zero. So for V zero, the potential, epsilon, and we should label that, I guess, with the K, epsilon K, so no superscript zero here. This is the actual thing we're solving for. The superscript zero means we know it. It's just the H bar squared Q squared over 2M. The epsilon K equals epsilon K minus G1, we'll call it. So some G. And C K minus G1 is of order 1. And C K minus G is approximately 0 for G not equal to G1. Okay, and that's true if we draw these parabolas again. That's true if we're interested in this particular K here. Okay, because now the G, so this is your G1, this is say G2. For G1, it's true that epsilon K equals that. And then the coefficient associated with that will be 1. And for G2 and for the next one, which is even higher up here, they're so far away that this is not 0. But the right-hand side is 0, therefore the coefficient has to be 0. Now, the exception is, what about if K is equal to a value where there are actually two of them equal? So suppose there's a group, you know, G1, G2, Gm, where epsilon 0 of K minus G1 equals epsilon 0 of K minus G2, dot, dot, dot. Then you have to take into account all of them. Okay, this is, so that's what we're going to do now. Let's see, this is the middle one. So, case one is that there's a epsilon k is about equal to epsilon k minus g1 for a particular g1 and all other epsilon k minus g zeros for g not equal to g1 are far away. Okay. Then, if I work through, running out of time, they're in the notes. So, what I want to say is, if you work this out, then you're going to find that CK minus G1 is of order one, and CK minus G for G not equal to G1 is small. Let's just call it small. Okay, basically what I said over there. And when you, so when you work that out, I'll skip some steps here, you find that epsilon k is equal to epsilon k minus g1 zero plus a correction, which is sum of g not equal to g1 of v g prime, so we'll call this g prime, minus g1 all squared divided by that energy denominator. So the correction is of order v squared. And remember, the potential is weak, so this is a higher order correction than, for example, a linear correction. So it means there isn't going to be much change. In fact, there's it's stronger than that, right? Because this is small, but this denominator is small because all these other ones are far away. I mean, the denominator is big, so therefore one over the denominator is small. And if you examine this expression, if this is your k minus g1 level, and these other levels are down, you know, there's another level down here, then as you turn on V, this thing goes up. Okay, so there's this level repulsion that this tends to want to move away from the other levels. If you examine the denominators here and the signs here, you'll see that that's true. And likewise, if you have a situation where you're looking at this level and now you turn on V, this thing will go down. So this will be K minus G1 epsilon and epsilon. So again, this will be repelled from the levels above by going down, and this will be repelled from the levels below by going up. The second case is when you have this situation and you want to look at k right here. So you want to look at k where there are two branches, and we'll call them g1 and g2. Then you have to write equations for both. You have to write epsilon k minus g1 times c k minus g1 minus if we just treat two of them here, minus G2 minus G1 CK minus G2 equals zero. And the other case is epsilon K minus G2 times CK minus G2 minus VG1 minus G2 CK minus G1. So there are two equations and two unknowns, and so the determinant of that has to be zero. So if you set the determinant of that equal to zero, you will get that epsilon k, it's a quadratic, is equal to epsilon k minus g1 of 0 plus epsilon k minus g2 of 0 divided by 2 plus or minus the square root of epsilon k minus g1 minus epsilon k minus g2 all squared plus v of g1 minus g2 magnitude squared. So you get corrections like this. And this looks quadratic, but not quadratic in V when epsilon k minus g1 of 0 is equal to epsilon k minus g2 of 0. So, which is precisely right at this point. Okay, so when these two, and that's referred to as a Bragg plane, and that shows up in Bragg scattering when you do X-ray diffraction. When that's true, these two are equal, you get the original energy level, plus or minus, this is zero, so you get epsilon k equals epsilon k minus g1, 0, plus or minus the magnitude of v. So it's linear. And you get those pictures that you've already seen where this thing just simply goes over like that, and this one goes over like that. And we don't even bother drawing that side. But they bend over like that, and this gap now is going to be 2 times v of g1 minus g2 magnitude. Okay, so basically when you've got a weak potential, what you're finding is that most of the effect of the potential occurs at the so-called Bragg planes. And again, to visualize this in 3 dimensions is much more difficult, but in 1 dimension, it's quite clear there's simply a plane out of the board here that bisects G1 and G2, and it's on that plane that the spectrum will change. Okay, I showed you those slides. We've run out of time, so I won't show them to you again. Any questions? Okay, well, feel free to ask me later if they come up. Tomorrow we're going to look at the other extreme, which is tight binding.